Welcome.
This is an awesome podcast. This is one of my favorite ones.
To the Jeff.
It's a lot of whiskey, Jeff.
Macalino.
Jeff Macalino. Macalino. Macalino.
Podcast. Hey, welcome to another fresh episode of the podcast. Got my first of probably back-to-back, actually maybe three in a row, you could argue, kind of intelligent podcasts coming at you. My guest today is Noah Healy. He is a professional algorithm developer and recreational mathematician who has become an expert on game theory and designing marketplaces. Building on breakthroughs merging physics and mathematics in the 20th century, he has developed a patent-pending system to supersede commodity markets. Did that confuse you? Because it confused me, but not after I talked to Noah. It's a fun conversation. I asked him to explain everything to me like I'm a 10-year-old, which helped me make sense of everything, I think. No, it was a fun conversation. You know, I heard, and it's not that difficult of a concept, but it's one of those game theory, one of those things you hear about, but you know, you don't really ask what it is, or if you're like me. So we talk about that. We talk about commodity markets, just understanding how they work now, and then how what his system would, how it would change it. We talk about recreational math. And I was going to say a joke around at the end, but I edit out my IQ when I tell him. I think he was surprised, which I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing. but Noah was a great sport. We talked, and he's one of those guests who I ended up talking to him for, God, probably 45 minutes after the podcast also about different stuff. So. Fun conversation, intelligent conversation. And if you're intelligent, you know what you probably want? It's Ibotta. It's the cashback shopping app that helps you save or earn cash back on purchases you're already going to make. Go into Publix, pull up the Ibotta app, click a few buttons, and boom. See, dollars come back into your account. It's very easy to get the money. Transfer it to your bank account. Use the app below so you get a free special introductory offer for being a listener of the Jeff Macalino podcast. Again, the link is below in the show notes. Ibotta. Ibotta. All right. I think that's about it as far as things I want to make sure to mention. I'm recording this 6 days before this episode comes out, so I'm sure something newsworthy will happen that will make this sound tone deaf, but I'm just gonna keep on rolling. Enjoy me and Noah Healy. All right, everybody, I'm very pleased to welcome Noah Healy to the Jeff Macalino podcast. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me here, Jeff.
Yeah, glad to have you. And I'll apologize again on the recording. You are the first guest out of, this is going to be episode 115, I believe. And you are the first guest who I've ever had to literally, I think it was like 2 minutes before we were supposed to record, my power went out. Sunny day, bright sunny day, and I'm just sitting here like, oh, it'll turn back on any second now, right? It did not.
Well, I'm glad we were able to connect again.
Yes, yes. That's I always piss and moan about guests who have done that to me, who like, you know, it's supposed to be 10 o'clock, and then at 10:15 I email them, hey, having some issues? Oh, I'm busy, I forgot. Let's reschedule. It's like, yeah, it's not like I shaped my whole day around this so that I could do the next thing. So I apologize. Not my fault. Really, but I still feel terrible about it. but we've got electricity now. Noah, I said before, you're probably going to expose how dumb I really am. I want to read your bio, and then basically I want you to explain in English, like I'm an 8 year old, what it means, because I know all the words, I just don't, not in the order that they're. So Noah is a professional algorithm developer and a recreational mathematician who is an expert on game theory and designing marketplaces. There's more here, but there's enough to start asking questions on that. I get algorithm developer, although I have no idea what that is. Recreational mathematician. I think I can make sense of that. I've heard you on another podcast talk about game theory. That's the thing I'd like you to explain to me. Like I'm 10 years old, if you don't mind starting there.
Okay, sure. Well, let's start with a game 10-year-olds play then. Rock, paper, scissors. So rock, paper, scissors is a two-player zero-sum game.
Yeah.
It's a two-player game because there's two players. It's zero-sum because one person wins and the other person loses. And presumably, they both care about winning and losing the same amount. If they don't, it isn't zero-sum anymore.
Okay.
Rock, paper, scissors has the property that everything you do can win, and everything you do can lose, and everything you do can draw. So what's an ideal strategy in rock, paper, scissors? Well, pure strategy would be throwing rock, throwing paper, throwing scissors. And the pure strategies all have obvious flaws. If you have some pure strategy that you would pursue, I can exploit that pure strategy. Mm-hmm. So if you're a rock thrower, I can know that or learn that and become a paper thrower and dominate you. So you say, well, okay, I'll just become a scissors thrower then. Well, now we've started talking about mixed strategies, how to react to things. And as a general rule, ideal strategies in these types of situations is opponent indifference. You want to reach the point where whatever your opponent does, it's roughly the same to you. Because in a zero-sum game, your gain is their loss, and their gain is your loss. So if you do care what they do, they're going to do the thing that you want the least. So what's the best strategy in rock, paper, scissors? Random. One-third rock, one-third paper, one-third scissors. And if it's random, there's no exploit to happen. You don't know what you're going to throw, so they can't figure out what you're going to throw.
Okay. So, all right. So basically it's, okay, I can see how that works with rock, paper, scissors. I mean, that makes enough sense. Although, for some reason, I'm terrible at that game.
Well, you know, being a rock thrower, which most of us are slightly.
You know why I'm a rock thrower? Dumb side conversation here. It's because you never know if people are going to be like rock, paper, scissors, shoot, and they're going to immediately shoot or they're going to hold. So it's always in a rock already. So I just keep it there so I don't look stupid the first time. So
there you go.
I just gave away. Everyone's going to go paper on me first.
That's right. That's right. We've got the Jeff Macliano exploit.
Yeah, always go paper first,
right here.
See, now I'm gonna bust out the scissors.
That's right.
My first thought is if I'm going against a known rock thrower, I'm gonna throw rock the first time, thinking they're gonna try to switch it up on me. And worst case, you draw. You're not gonna, you know, they're never gonna throw paper.
Sure.
Presumably.
Now that was a two-player zero-sum game. There's two different ways that we can alter that. We can make it a multiplayer game, or you can make it a non-zero sum game. And non-zero sum games are where things get really interesting, because this is where the structure of the game starts driving behavior. So there's a game called the fair division algorithm. So you've got a couple of kids, you got the last piece of cake. You need to divide up the cake in half so that it's fair. How do you do that? Well, the fair division algorithm. have one of the kids cut the cake and have the other kid choose which half of the cake they want to cut. Now, in one sense, dividing up the cake is a zero-sum game. One kid's gain is the other kid's loss. But by doing it this way, it becomes a cooperative game in solving that non-zero-sum game in a fair fashion. As it turns out, there are fair divisions rules for any number of players. Unfortunately, the fair division algorithm is what's known as an exponential algorithm. So basically, the amount of work you have to do increases by a constant factor every time you add somebody to the party. So if having, you know, dividing a cake among two kids takes about a second, and dividing it among three kids would take about 2 seconds, dividing it among 10 kids would take about 40 minutes or 20 minutes. And dividing it among 100 kids would take, you know, longer than the United States has been around. Well, not quite. 20,000 minutes? That's not, or no, no, 92. Yeah, that would be until the end of the universe. So you're basically adding another 27 zeros to add 90 more kids.
It's a long time.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The cake is atomized before you actually worked out what the fair division is. So we can't use fairness for everything using the techniques that we know can produce fairness. So we use other types of things. And so we have these little stories about very simple two-player non-zero-sum games to give us a sense of like what sort of strategies you should engage in. So for marketplaces and economics, one useful one is called the stag hunt. And this posits two people are going to go out hunting. They can hunt for stags, deer, or rabbits, hares. If you hunt for a rabbit, you catch a rabbit for a day. If you hunt for a stag and the other person also hunts for a stag, you catch a stag and both of you can eat for a week. So if you're in the stag hunt and you're stag hunting, you're better off hunting stags as long as everybody else is also hunting stags.
Right.
If other people don't want to go for that, then you're way better off hunting hares because you're going to catch a hare you're going to eat. So depending on how many options and how many players there are, people become more conservative or more going for the brass ring, ambitious, depending on those kinds of factors. But if you play the game over and over again with a group, the other name for the stag hunt is the stagnation game. Whatever people sort of settle on initially is what they keep doing. So if you get two groups of people and one starts out mostly hunting hares and the other one starts out mostly hunting stags, then pretty quickly everyone will be hunting hares in group one, everybody hunting stags in group two. And over sequential time, the stag hunters will have gotten a lot better off than the hare hunters have.
Right.
And there's been social psychology experiments done with people from different countries with different levels of socioeconomic development. And what they discover is that in general, people from wealthier countries are more willing to be ambitious and trusting initially. And people from less wealthy countries are less willing to be ambitious and trustful initially. And so that simple like internal instinct causes a divergence. I was giving a lecture on this once, and I'd come up with this way to interact with people where you get them to raise their hands, either their right hands or their left hands, depending on which side of these two-player, two-choice type games that they want to be in. And it was a group of computer programmers. And while I was introducing the game, one of them said, you know, why would anybody ever do anything other than hunting a stag? So I was like, okay, let's give this a shot. And and I gave him the rule, if everybody in the room hunts stags, you'll catch stags. If ever, you know, otherwise anybody that catches hares, catch hares. One guy in the room was a little bit iconoclastic, sort of wanted to teach the room a lesson, and he raised his left hand. And so an entire room full of very well-to-do computer programmers got caught out and got zeros because one guy decided to raise his left hand instead of his right hand. And if you're in an environment where it's a little bit more harsh and you're a little bit less likely to be trusting, you can get into a situation where just that initial impetus creates a trap that it's very hard to climb out of, because mm-hmm. you can't go stag hunting by yourself. You need other people to come with you.
It's interesting. And I think something that popped into my head as you're saying that with the stagnation is almost, obviously you're talking a lot from business terms, but I think even personal wise, I mean, I think of kind of the glass ceiling that people put on themselves where, look, I know people who have said, I can't get a raise because I don't get these government benefits if I make more money. That's kind of the, you know, again, short-term thinking of, I'll eat every day by hunting the hare instead of taking a big swing to long-term better myself and hunt for the stag by going for it. And I mean, maybe the analogy is not perfect, but that's...
No. Game theory does apply to ordinary life. I mean, strategy shows up all over the place. One of the most interesting things in the sort of history and sociology of game theory is that many of the sort of core mathematical theorems, the proofs of those things, are actually classified documents. And so they're known as the folk theorems because the actual original proofs can't be published. And that's because the people that were developing game theory were mostly working for government think tanks back in the 50s and 60s. And so things like the mutual assured destruction nuclear strategy that underpinned the Cold War was developed by game theorists at the Rand Corporation of the Pentagon. And those are the guys that actually did the proofs of how evolutionary games and so on originally, you know, got out. So game theory was considered a classified like government secret for several decades. And then, you know, sort of people came to their senses and realized that it's just math. But it does apply from sort of these very high level global strategic conditions to just action in your personal life. And stagnation is something that we have to struggle against in our job, in relationships. You know, being on the same page with your significant other is way better than not being on the same page as your significant other. But if the two of you have gotten onto the same page of, you know, eating peas and broccoli on Tuesdays, and it turns out you both hate that, but you've got the schedule and now you're stuck. You know, if you can break that stagnation, it would benefit you, but breaking stagnation is a hard thing to do.
Right. It takes, well, you can use a lot of words for it. Cojones, guts, whatever you want to call it. When you're discussing the top secret, global stuff, you know, with the game theory, every dumb podcast host, I'm sure, says, oh, like global thermonuclear war in war games, right?
Yeah. Well, and that...
I mean, and we're not wrong, but...
Right. No. Well, that's actually, you know, at the very core of war games, it's a much more relevant story because, you know, it's the Whopper is a superintelligence that has to learn about futility. Mm-hmm. And so that's the core, you know, in rock, paper, scissors, there's a draw option. If you're thinking about nuclear war, only in terms of winning and losing, and not realizing that win or loss, what was the thing in Dr. Strangelove? No more than 20 million killed tops. I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, Mr. President.
Yeah, yeah, that's a lose lose,
right?
Yeah, I mean, yes. that's pretty much war in a nutshell, almost always. I feel like
pretty much, yeah. And that gets us over into non-zero sum games, which don't have to be positive like the stack hunt. They can be negative as well. So games like chicken, where you basically can choose to be brave or cowardly. And if you choose to be brave and your opponent chooses to be cowardly, then you win. But if both of you choose to be brave, you really, really both lose.
Yeah, yeah. We both won. We're dead.
Right. So one person can win or both people can lose in two different ways. So that's a negative sum game.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like almost anything involving cars is...
Well, and chicken is also very much where war comes in. So the whole prelude to war is sort of a, you know, brinkmanship style negotiation where there's something to be shared among multiple parties and both parties want most of it. And so they push. It's like, maybe I could get a little bit more here. And I get a little bit more there. And once they're pushing on each other, then either somebody's going to back down and voluntarily lose, or they're going to crash into each other and see what happens. And sometimes people back down, sometimes they don't. And then you get that outcome.
Yeah, I was going to say it's such a stupid macho thing, and then I remembered that's kind of how I ended up on the hood of my friend's car, because I said, he's not going to hit me. I mean, he did slow down.
Well, and so in that context, you know, strikes. Things like Hollywood writer strikes or you know, you have people who are making hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, like, you know, baseball players go on strike and right. People are like, well, you know, these guys are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Their salaries are effectively being paid by people who are working class, you know, team supporters that make $40,000 a year. Like, what do they have to complain about? But they don't have nothing to complain about. And so they push and the owners push back and maybe they come to a consensus. Maybe they both back off or, you know, maybe one of them, you know, piles the other one under, or maybe they shut down the league for a season.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the worst case scenario
for
a sports fan. So I think I get, game theory. I mean, I think I understand I'm sure there's a lot more to it, obviously, than what we've talked about. Now you are trying to utilize this to kind of, I'm probably going to say something wrong here, but to shift financial systems.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does that work? Or you probably have to explain it like I'm in kindergarten again, where I said 10 years old. That's like, what, third grade?
Well, there might be some 10-year-olds in third grade, but social promotion's taken pretty heavy hold these days, so most of them make it to fifth. So economic systems are their service provision. And what they're fundamentally about is people that have an interest in trading. So when you go to the grocery store, you know, you're not going at gunpoint. You want to buy food, and they're not going at gunpoint. They want to sell you food. They're going to make some money and it's worth the money that you're paying to you to buy the stuff that you're buying.
Right.
So that's a positive sum game. There's a surplus of value that's available from the coming together of two people who have common interests. And if you have enough of people who have common interests around the same kind of product, then there's a lot of surplus value available.
So how does that translate outside of the supermarket?
So we've got buyers coming together with sellers.
Right.
So the question is, what's the price point? Where do those two sides come together? And that's where things start getting a little bit more like chicken or these negotiations, because the sellers would love to get more money. The buyers would love to spend less money. So the gap between the least money that could be spent and the most money that could be spent, there's room there, and there's shoving, and there can be some, you know, going home and waiting to see if everybody wants to cool off and maybe think about it tomorrow, and so on. And so what the way the current marketplace works is effectively a bunch of people jump into a pit and have these shoving matches, but in public. And so you kind of get to see who's winning and where the line of demarcation kind of is before you decide, when you jump into the pit, what hill you will or will not be dying on.
So how does it implement? Do you know what I'm saying? How does it, I understand what you're saying. How does this get implemented so that it is something that average Joe dummy can do? Does the question make sense?
Yeah, sure. Well, at the core, if you're familiar with, like, you know, stock tickers, mm-hmm. that's how the line demarcation is set. So every time somebody wins one of these contests, a record's made and it's published to the entire world that this deal has just gone off. The trick is that in many cases, computer mediation has taken over. And so every microsecond, some number of deals happens,
right,
or potentially some number of deals happens. So over the course of the amount of time it takes you to blink, 100,000 sets of deals can take place.
Right.
And that's more information than your brain or anybody's brain can take in. Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to say, but, you know, and so people use computer programs to take these things in and kind of, you know, massage them. And that's where, if you've heard about robot trading or machine trading, that's where the things like that come in. And so the system is basically just carrying out this war of people who are making offers and seeing whether or not anything takes, and then publishing the ones that do for several hours a day, 5 days a week. And that's how it currently functions.
So in your model, I mean, is this for every day? Like, is there eggs, for example? I know that's kind of the trending thing. Hopefully when this airs in what, 9 days or something, it's eggs have come down a lot, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I really hope so. Eggs are a staple part of my diet, at least. So eggs, apparently there's some kind of bird flu going around that's getting rid of egg laying. And so now eggs are expensive. And eggs are expensive, so that there'll be eggs. If they kept eggs at the old 9 cent price, but only put out, you know, half as many of them, then some people would come to the store and buy eggs and not notice anything's going on. And the other half of the people would go to the store and see empty shelves and say, hey, what's going on? Like, yeah. Why aren't there any eggs? So the price comes up so that people that don't want eggs as much don't buy eggs. And the people who want eggs more do buy eggs. And at the same time, the people who can sell eggs are selling eggs for a bunch of money. So people who can figure out a way to make eggs decide to get themselves into the egg making business to start producing some more eggs and get eggs into the system, because you'll make a lot of money right now. So there's sort of layers of how this system functions. There's the core of just like getting it going. And then there's the reason why the core is important in organizing an economy to function properly. And then there's the actual craft, technical, and capital capacity to use eggs to make souffle or to raise a bunch of extra chickens or whatever is required to get all that stuff worked out properly.
So, and that reminds me, I'm pretty sure it was my brother. I hope it was, because, well, not that anyone's going to care who I credit on a podcast, but I think it was my brother who joked. He's up in North Florida and has chickens, and they lay eggs. And he was talking about setting up a eggs to crypto trading system app, so he could you know, trade his eggs for cryptocurrency.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a currency, then that's what you use it for buying things of value.
Now, with the system where all the trades are, you know, basically just public record on a ticker, how does that, I'm just thinking in practicality of, you know, I walk into Publix grocery store, and obviously they have a price on the eggs that I presume is not going to be changing every, you know, millisecond when someone buys eggs across the country or the state or whatever level. Is it just like I'd look at the ticker on my phone, say, well, the eggs here are $5.99 for a dozen and I should only be paying $5.32. I'm going to go elsewhere. Or,
well, so the ticker is about the common pit, and that's actually what they used to be called, pits. If you've ever seen Trading Places, that group of guys that are all shouting at each other, mm-hmm. that was the frozen concentrated orange juice pit.
Yeah.
So the price is only active inside the pit. And also, moving physical stuff around is pretty inconvenient. So what they generally trade isn't stuff right now, because moving all the oil and steel and wheat and corn on Earth to, like, you know, New York and Chicago before sending it back to wherever it needs to actually get used would be really expensive. What they do is they trade deals instead. So they trade the deal to do the trade, and they don't trade the deal to do the trade right now. They trade the deal to do the trade in the future. So there's you wouldn't buy eggs in Chicago if there was an egg pit. You would buy a deal to buy a, like, refrigerator truck full of eggs next March.
Gotcha. So,
or next April, or next June, or 3 years from now in February.
And that's, I'm very ignorant when it comes to this, but that's commodity trading, correct?
That's commodity trading. And so what they do is they set up a schedule. It's generally approximately monthly. And each one of their scheduled clearance dates has contracts built around it. And then the people that are running those industries trade in those markets to hedge their risks and sort of use cost averaging and stuff like that to actually do their deals, if they don't already have a deal that's in the queue. So as a farmer, you could have bought one of these contracts to deliver eggs in March, or you can sort of go on the spot where they're going to be taking a look at what it looks like markets are doing and what's going on, and they'll quote you a price, you know, for eggs that show up. And that price isn't going to be as good on average than you could get if you knew everything, but you don't. So, and the thing about the spot is that it can swing a lot. So there's an upside risk and a downside risk. And if you're in a capital intensive business with low margins, i.e. you're a commodity producer, well, upside risks are fantastic and you're happy to have them. Downside risks are intolerable.
Now, in a system like this, kind of the, a fractional win system, would that be?
So it's, As far as game theory terms, this is a positive sum system, but there's some conflict in it, and so that's a property. The classic positive sum conflicting game is called the Battle of the Sexes, and it posits two people who are going to go out on a date, man and a woman. They're either going to go to the ball game or the opera. And both of them would prefer to be with each other over being at their favorite thing, but they each have a favorite thing and it's not the same thing. So the guy would like to be with the girl at the ball game and the girl would be like to be with the guy at the opera. And she'd rather be with the guy at the ball game than at the opera by herself. Like they really do love each other, but they really do have different interests. And so the buyers and sellers, in one sense, have a common interest because they need the deal to happen to be in business. But in another sense, they have opposed interests because the better the deal is for one of them, the worse it is for the other one. And so you get this situation, again, going back to our earlier examples, like the strikes and so on. It's a much better deal to, like, keep your movie studio operating and cranking out blockbusters than shutting everything down for a year because the actors are unhappy or the writers are unhappy or whatever. But it's a pretty good deal to shut it down so that when it starts back up again, you've got a piece of the streaming back end or the DVD sales. Or some other thing, which is now 90% of where the money comes from. Or, you know, these days, many things get paid for from the merchandising end of stuff.
Gotcha. So it's, I wonder with the kind of cutthroat, and I'm very much a capitalist, free market person. But that being said, I'm aware that there are people who, I don't even consider them capitalists. I consider them people who lobby government to change rules to benefit them to make themselves more money. Those kind of people, would they play a game like this where,
well, they do, you know, the markets have some degree of manipulation. There's money laundering that goes on within the marketplace. There's you know, the whole shorts thing, where the outside interest is sort of greater than the total sum of things. And also structurally, because they're trading deals and not stuff, the deals haven't really, you know, happened yet. So if I get a deal to buy eggs for, you know, $1 a hundred, you know, in March, and I get another deal to sell eggs for $1.10 in March, I never see any deals. You know, I can fulfill both of these deals by sort of cutting my middleman status out, gluing the other two sides together and handing them to two people who are on the other sides of those deals and just take 10 cents per hundred. So that's actually what happens. The number of trades that happen within these futures markets compared to the amount of delivered stuff that actually gets transferred through these markets is a ratio of like 40 to 50 to 1 for industrial commodities, generally speaking. So that would be foodstuffs, softs like lumber, metals. There's some commodities that are much worse than that. I think gold, I saw a figure of 80 to 1. So something like 98 and change percent of the gold market is people making deals with no intention to actually ever touch any gold.
That's interesting.
But even in a market like wheat or steel or something like that, 98% of the marketplace or 97.5% of the marketplace will be people who have absolutely no intention to ever touch the grain or wood or what have you.
So it's in essence to, I'm using a word with a negative connotation, but I don't intend it that way. It's just an effort to kind of grift some of the profits, some pennies off the top.
Well, it's a negotiation process, essentially. Sure. And so the key thing to understand what's going on is that people have knowledge about what's happening and what's going to be happening. And what they're doing is they're capitalizing that knowledge by disseminating it through the marketplace. The problem, and that's why marketplaces work, that's how they work, that's the entire goal of the marketplace. The problem is that we have these machines that do information dissemination now, and they can chop and find things out and so on. And so what you're capable of doing, you have access to this stuff, is essentially putting noise into your system. So just like you could play poker by betting all of your guaranteed winners and folding everything else, but everybody else would just stop playing with you. You know, they'll just take your antes, and whenever you bet, they'll let you have it because you're never bluffing. Mm-hmm. So in a poker environment, you have to start mixing the bluffs so that people will pay you when you've got it.
Right.
Well, the same thing happens in the marketplace. If everyone just tells everybody what they know, then the market will instantaneously adjust to that and essentially give everybody the worst deal they're willing to take. So you have to mix in some, well, maybe I want a better deal, type of behaviors. Or you're just going to get taken advantage of. And because computers give us a much greater facility, operating at microsecond timescales, to put in that noise, the system now has to contend with a lot more BS than it did when it was just guys shouting at each other in a pit. And it's not up to the task.
Right. I mean, because the guy with the smartphone is smarter than everyone screaming in the pit. I mean,
right. Yeah.
They have the information.
And there's like, a couple billion of us with smartphones.
Yes.
Yeah. So
not a rare commodity.
Right. Yeah. It's just overwhelming.
Gotcha. So I think I've grasped everything you're saying. I probably haven't, though. That's some people often.
No. Dunning-Kruger's a real thing, but I think you're doing okay.
I do have a question my son wanted me to ask you. But before I get to that, I do feel is there a step that I haven't asked about, or is there a step I'm missing in here?
Well, the very next step is where we get to what I'm doing.
Okay.
So what I did is figured out a way to basically take that internal negotiation fighting thing, flip it on its head, and make it so that the market as a whole will pay people for the amount of useful information that they're providing. by using these computers to actually measure how much information that you're putting out there. So people who are basically flooding the market with noise aren't going to get paid for the noise. They're only going to get paid for the information. And so by doing it that way, you get a situation where it's a negotiation, but instead of being a chicken style negotiation, it's a lot more like a stag hunt style negotiation, where the entire goal is to get everybody hunting stags so that the people that are offering that information are getting paid by people who are as rich as possible, so they get paid the most money possible.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense, actually. You that helps me tie it together even better. Now, how does that, I mean, without going too specific, because it'll go way over my head, but how do you go about, in if it's possible to explain in layman's terms, how does that get implemented?
Well, basically with a three-sided marketplace. So there's a marketplace in deal information, which is structured pretty similarly to the existing ticker. You've got dates of delivery and prices. Mm-hmm. You could do a lot more of them with this because there's not as many deals happening, basically. You're just talking about what the price level for the entire system is. So instead of about one price window a month, you could have one price window a day. And then you've got one batch of buyers and one batch of sellers. I call them producers and consumers to kind of distinguish them, because right now buyers and sellers are mostly traders. So there's an ongoing negotiation every day. People say what they think the future prices are going to look like, which might be very similar to what the market currently thinks, or it might be pretty different depending on what they feel like. The market takes in money from those people based on how divergent their views are from the system, and integrates all those things into tomorrow's projection of what the future looks like.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, today's projection of now and the future is published. And so the producers and consumers, it's basically like a grocery store. They know what the price is going to be. They decide how much they want to bring to the table. And the system then takes those two piles of stuff and trades as much of them as they can. So if people want to sell a million things and people want to buy a million and 10 things, 10 things don't get bought that people wanted to buy. But a million things that people wanted to buy do get bought. And so, you know, 99.9999% of the trades happen.
Gotcha. And almost, and this is probably a crude comparison because obviously the outcome is completely non-reliant, but it almost, in my head, seems like the way they adjust odds in a sporting event, where it's kind of live based on information. You know, you could open up with this team a 4-point favorite. If all the money's coming for them, they're going to be a 7-point favorite by the time the game rolls around. Obviously, the outcome of a sporting event is much different than trading commodities.
Yeah, but no, you're not far wrong. Going once again back to Trading Places, they have a little scene where the Duke brothers explain to Eddie Murphy like how things work, and the punchline of that scene is Eddie Murphy says, "Sounds to me like y'all are a couple of bookies." That's pretty much what's going on. And in fact, there's something called the Lang patent, which I had to read and demonstrate had nothing to do with what I was doing. That's like an 800-page mathematical dissertation where these guys defined every kind of parimutuel betting scheme that they could imagine, up to an infinite number of betting pools, and patented all of them. And they sold that patent to the Hong Kong Jockeys Club and the CME Group, formerly known as the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Hmm. Yeah, it is. I guess that's I guess in fairness to my analogy, I always used to say I don't trade stocks, but I can bet on sports. And isn't it the same thing? For me, I know more about sports than I do about the stock market. So it's probably a smarter.
In general, sort of. Yes, sadly.
Yeah. Stick with what you know. All right. Well, then, no, that's I think you've taught me. Well, I know you've taught me a few things. And I like the way that sounds. Is there a key on your end to actually, I think I'd read it's patent pending what you're doing, but is there a key to actually like the next step to getting it to?
I'm working with several people who have financial institutions or are trying to build them that want to incorporate my technology. But that's the key, is that it takes a certain amount of capital resources to be able to deploy this in the world. And so I need to find people with access to that, or build a movement so large of people that want that, you know, you can acquire the funding externally. So like Robinhood actually managed to put together a successful viral campaign to have like 10 million people sign up for their service before it existed. And then they took that and got the money to build it. That's very sus, but then so is Robinhood's actual business model. So
yeah. Yeah. Just because I had mentioned it previously, is this solely going to be a dollars kind of thing, or is there going to be a crypto element possibly mixed in, or is that all just up to?
A handful of the people I'm working with are crypto companies. Wherever it starts is wherever it starts. In terms of currency of use, it could be local versions of exchange. So it could be euros in Europe or you know, Australian dollars in Australia. I just talked to a guy a couple days ago that was thinking about building crypto exchange based in West Africa. So it could be a crypto thing using some sort of, you know, West African currency peg or just West African currency. Africa is the most digital money intensive region on earth, actually. So not as much difference there. So yeah, we'll see who actually manages to get up off the couch first.
Interesting. And I'm impressed looking at the clock that I've almost gone an hour talking to you, and I haven't given up. I give my brain some credit for playing the game.
Well, yeah, thank you for persevering.
No, and you just to be clear, you have not bored me at all. You've kept me engaged. You threw me for a loop a couple times, but that was again not your fault. That was just my tracking the conversation. I haven't been drinking alcohol, so my brain's just not firing on all cylinders.
Right. Yeah.
We'll blame that. Well, the question my son wanted to ask, which I found hilarious, because I read your bio to him. He's like, "How does one become a recreational mathematician?" I'm like, "I'm pretty sure that's a self-given title. Like, I could call myself a recreational golfer or something." But I figured I'd ask just to clarify.
Yeah. Well, it is absolutely a self-given title. Recreational math, however, is a sort of recognized thing. And there's been some interesting outputs of recreational math, which would include my project. One of my favorite examples, the patterns. So there are a certain number of ways to create repeating patterns on a flat surface that will sort of go on forever. And while there's sort of an infinite number of ways that you can sort of add a little curly Q to the edge of the square array or stuff like that, at a more general level, those would all just count as square lattice patterns or triangular lattice patterns or so on and so forth. So there's a guy named Martin Gardner who used to write the the final word of a magazine called Games Magazine, which would have a bunch of things and also sort of supported recreational mathematics. And he wrote an article about how there were, I can't even remember what the exact numbers are anymore, but I think it was like 11 patterns known to mankind of how to tessellate the plane. And a housewife from California, I believe, had read this article and decided that it was interesting to think about, you know, how many different kinds of wallpaper patterns there could be. And that's actually, it's called the wallpaper problem. And so she started thinking about it. She invented her own notation. She invented something like 5 or 6. I remember she basically increased the total number of known human patterns by 50%. And a few years later, she wrote something to Martin Gardner saying, hey, you know, I've been thinking about this for a few years and check this out. And so he wrote something. It's like, hey, look, this is a thing. I saw a paper in Topology. This is probably about 7 years ago now, where some topologist had raised the number. I believe we're currently up to 27. And how many could there be? Like, I'm pretty sure we don't know. The fact that we're at 27, you know, sort of strongly suggests to me that the number is actually infinite. Although there are some very big fixed numbers in mathematics, and it might be related to one of those. But we don't know. And it's not of any great practical importance. But it's interesting. People play around with it. There's more to come. And probably the most important piece of recreational mathematics in all of human history was number theory, which is still ongoing to this day. And that's questions concerning the properties of integers. Probably the most famous number theoretic problem is that, you know, Pythagorean triples exist, that there are a squared plus b squared can equal c squared, where a, b, and c are integers. And that other powers like that can't exist. A to the third plus b to the third can never equal a perfect cube. Solving that problem was actually worth $1 million to Andrew Wiles. Well, it turns out that number theory is the technological machinery required to make cryptography possible. And so cryptocurrencies, online banking, Amazon, communication that can't be, like, this communication right here is being encrypted over the internet,
right?
Packet by packet. All of that stuff was based on mathematics that was worked out by mostly pretty bright guys who were interested in problems that looked like they were purely meaningless, except they happened to be true, for quite literally thousands of years. And then in the 1970s, it was worked out that you could upgrade cryptography in a very serious way. The mathematics was actually classified. There's a guy that went to jail because he published a math paper that had the wrong kind of stuff in it. And now a significant fraction of the human economy is entirely based on the properties of certain very, very large prime numbers, or elliptic curve theories, which it turns out have been proved are very much related to, and in fact, exactly the same problem as the properties of very, very large prime numbers.
I can't get the vision out of my head of some guy in prison. What are you in for? I published a math paper.
Right. Yeah.
You're not, that guy's going to have a rough go. I probably want to say he killed somebody. And how does, people who listen to my podcast, I generally assume are of my intelligence, but how would somebody who has a genius son who is bored with his gifted math program, How does one like recreational math isn't something I've ever even heard of. I mean, it again, the words make sense, but it's obviously a thing that just how does one discover it? Or I mean, is it just as simple as go on the internet and type in recreational math and
that will do it? I was alive back when Games Magazine still existed and Martin Gardner contributed to from time to time, so you can run across it in that fashion. You can gain independent interests. At one point, I was in a games club, and so I was familiar with role-playing game systems. And there was a system that was developed for a game called Legend of Five Rings, where the way things worked is that you rolled some dice, and if the sum of the dice was high enough, then you succeeded, and if it wasn't high enough, that you failed. But the trick was the number of dice you rolled, you had two different numbers on your sheet. You'd add those numbers together, you'd roll that many dice, and then you get to keep one of that set of dice. So you might roll like six dice and keep three of them. Or you might roll four dice and keep all of them. And it was 10-sided dice. When you rolled a 10, you got to re-roll and add it to itself. So you could roll infinitely big numbers if you kept rolling 10s. So just on a lark, I decided to see what I could learn about that system. And I came up with this bizarre characteristic polynomial approach that actually accurately plots out the expected values of these curves. Unfortunately, it doesn't actually get you the underlying structure. And so I wound up writing a computer program to do some Monte Carlo methods so I could actually visualize the distribution patterns properly. And so that's it. You get interested in some problem. You're like, oh, well, that's, you know, I don't immediately understand how that works. Maybe I'll toy around with it and see if there's an approach that could work out that way. I would recommend, and I have on other podcasts, the works of Raymond Smullyan. He's a logician and combinatorist who wrote highly accessible puzzle books to introduce several important ideas in computation and logic that aren't really anyplace else. But Lewis Carroll, that was his pen name. His real name was Charles Dodgson. He actually also wrote some instructional manuals and puzzle books under the name Charles Dodgson, although some of them also published under Lewis Carroll. He was probably the greatest Aristotelian logician that will ever live. He more or less completely finished out what you can and cannot do with syllogism. And it's called symbolic logic. And he's got a great book. I've got a copy of it on what that means. And so from a logic perspective, those are sort of good dives. A lot of the papers from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s on computational systems are incredibly accessible. There's one famous one titled Go To Considered Harmful by a man named Edsger Dijkstra. And I'm pretty sure I didn't mispronounce that. That's really his name. He didn't come up with the title, but it's a fascinating piece of sarcastic takedown in the mathematical space where he essentially excoriates the entire popular paradigm of programming of the day as total trash and something that only poor children would engage in. And it's an excellent read.
And when was that?
Go To Considered Harmful, I believe, is from the 70s.
Okay. Interesting. Well, you've you've helped expand my brain. You've got some synapses popping or whatever happens in there. I don't know. Where can my audience go to follow Noah Healy or find out what's going on?
Well, best way to is to reach out to me personally. I've got an email, noahphealy@yahoo.com. If you want to chase what I'm doing, LinkedIn, publish what's going on there. So I'm Noah Healy, just plain old Noah Healy on LinkedIn. And I've got a website, CoreDisc, CoreDisc.com. That's got a lot of the materials for like what my project and how you, the nuts and bolts of how you set up a marketplace so that it functions better.
Gotcha. Well, Noah, the last thing I want to do, I'm going to edit out, but I kind of want to hear your reaction. if I told you what my IQ was last time I took an IQ test, I feel like you'd be like, oh, Jesus, I thought it was much lower. I'm going to edit out the answer, but probably not your reaction. Maybe I'll edit out this whole thing. but the last time I was in my late 20s. Now I just turned 36, and it was
nice.
Yeah, you expected much lower than that, didn't you?
Oh,
I should have made you write down your answer.
You're pretty bright, but that's not bad. Well, yeah, you're in the genius range.
There you go. See. If only the alcohol didn't completely make everything mush. well, Noah, thank you so much for joining me. I had a good time talking with you. I can't believe, honestly, I did not expect to talk to you this long, and I'm only stopping because of the clock. I expected to be like, I don't know what he's saying. I got to bail out of this. so thank you for, I mean, in reality, thank you for making it something that I feel like everyone should be able to comprehend. That's a challenge in itself, I would imagine.
That's one of my major goals when going on things like this is to get it into something like that, because quite frankly, the economy needs to be something that we comprehend because we depend on it. And it's gotten to be too complicated for us, and not just sort of the masses, but the people that are operating it as well. So it's not like the Treasury Secretary or the governors of the Fed are some sort of picked special geniuses that understand what's happening. They've got a tiger by the tail, and mm-hmm. I think many of them don't even have the capacity to understand that's how bad it is. And we're all currently just along for the ride.
Yeah. I think my IQ is two standard deviations than most people involved in the government personally. two standard deviations higher. I should. but again, Noah, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
You bet. Thank you for having me here.
That's it. That's all. Hope you had a ball. Thank you, Noah, for joining me. You can check out his website. You can hook up with him on LinkedIn if you so please. Some interesting stuff. I'm going to test out and try some recreational mathematics. I actually also talked to him about doing, and he maybe will be a part of this, about doing a maybe one episode where I do a drunk versus sober IQ test. Be an interesting science experiment, would it not? Yeah. So, hey, let me know what you think of the episode. You're always free to email me, message me on any of the social medias where I hope you're following me, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I'm trying to start doing TikToks. I just keep forgetting. Really hate TikTok. And subscribe to the YouTube channel, because I put clips up there of episodes. And, I got some fun stuff up there. I think when this comes out, I'm okay to start promoting the Man Show Live, which you can find on YouTube. If it's up and running, it should be a live show, as you could tell by the word live, that I am doing. I'm co-hosting. I'll put a link in the show notes if it's up. If not, stay tuned. Some fun stuff planned, some good production quality on the end of the gentleman who is running the whole thing. I'll talk more about that when there's more to talk about. Let's see. Next week, I got a science guy for you, like a real one. Gosh dang it, a molecular biologist, I believe. We talk a lot about from the Big Bang to space exploration. So come back next week for much more interesting and intelligent discussion. And until next time, boom, it's over. Thanks for listening.
It was amazing. I loved it.
Be sure to come back for another great episode.
I'm one wing away from Jeff Macalino.
Of the Jeff Macalino Podcast.
How much time did you spend on thinking of the name of your podcast? You want just straight, that's my name, I'll add the word podcast to it.
Yup. See you next week.